Hi, it's Robin with Tributaries. In researching an answer to a problem, geniuses will tell us there comes a time when assumptions and cherished outcomes fall away, and it's there, in the stillness, that the aha exposes itself. Today's guest, Stefan Schwartz, has put his attention on the further reaches of the human mind. Maybe it's even egotistical to claim credit as a human mind, because whether it's being a genius, a psychic, a remote viewer, or artist extraordinaire, tapping in is perhaps where being human meets truly conscious mind. Stefan's fantastic research and projects, tracing both the process and results, have been documented in his books, The Secret Vault of Time, The Alexandria Project, Mind Rover, and most recently, Opening to the Infinite. Stay tuned for part one. This is Tributaries. Stefan, welcome. In the intro to Opening to the Infinite, you recount the results of a remote viewing class that was prompted to find Saddam Hussein. Maybe you can use this example to tell our audience what remote viewing is.
Of course. Well, let me say very briefly that remote viewing is first and foremost just a protocol. It's a kind of mental martial art or a sort of mental yoga. It is designed to allow you to access that part of yourself that is outside of time-space, the part that people would traditionally have called psychic or intuitive, or it is the part that produces hunches and women's gut, women's intuition or men's gut instinct or all of those kinds of things. And it is a way of allowing someone to describe sense impressions that they have about a person, place, or event from which they are separated by reason of time or space. We developed it back in the 70s. Hal Puthoff, Russ Targ, Ingo Swann, Ed May, a small group of people. And originally what we were trying to do was develop a protocol that would allow us to get this information and in such a way that it could be independently and objectively verified. So at its simplest, it's just a it's like learning yoga positions. In the instance that you are describing, I was teaching a class, seminar at a college or a university, and the people who were in the audience said to me, "Oh, we want to do something that's really important." I had been describing for them how individuals describe people who are hidden someplace, or objects that are hidden, or things that had been reduced down to micro dots that you couldn't read, and all sorts of different ways we had designed for doing experiments in which people provided us with both the sense information, the taste, touch, smell, and also a sense of knowingness, just a sort of I know how what I know, but I don't know how I know it sort of stuff. And so at that time, this is, 2003, and the big news story of the moment was, where is Saddam Hussein? So I thought, this is in November, so I thought, well, okay, that'd be a good thing to do. It'd be a great target because it's something there for which there's a lot of interest. People are highly motivated. It is very numinous, that is, it has a lot of emotional charge to it, so that'd be a good thing to try. So I just, on the spur of the moment, I asked these people to take out a piece of paper and a pencil, and then I said to them, okay, close your eyes, take a deep breath, take another deep breath, take a third deep breath. I want you to go forward in time to the moment when Saddam Hussein is discovered by either U.S. or the collaborative troops that were working with us. And I want you to go forward to that time, and I want you to describe where he is. I want you to describe what he's wearing. I want you to describe what his mindset is. How does he feel? Who's with him? What does he have with him? All those kinds of questions. Exactly the sort of questions that a journalist or a detective would ask if he was trying to reconstruct an event that had happened. Say there had been an automobile accident or somebody had been hurt in some way, and the detective or journalist didn't personally witness it, so they would go around and talk to lots of different people, and not everything everybody told them would be correct, because people's memories are not perfect. And even when they see things, as we know from the first person witness material, they get things wrong. But if you took a number of such interviews and then you looked at them, and looking for the places where there was consensus or unusually odd observations, you would be able, as happens every day, thousands and thousands of time in newspapers and police departments, you would be able to reconstruct a pretty good approximation of what took place. And so that's exactly the process. So I ask them these questions, just like a journalist or detective would have asked them, and they wrote down their answers, and I did an analysis. 47 people took part in this experiment. And it was a real experiment, because at the time that they provided the information, nobody had any idea where Saddam Hussein was. I personally thought that he had probably done what Idi Amin had done, and that is he had gone to some Middle Eastern country, and he had billions of dollars at his disposal, and he'd paid him a lot of money, and just as the Saudis took Idi Amin in. Saddam Hussein was... at the time, when people described him, he was so notably a fastidious man about his personal hygiene and his clothing. I mean, you might not like his style, but people who interviewed him at the time, prior to that, all commented on the fact of how fastidious he was. So it was hard for me to imagine this guy sort of on the run. In any case, when I looked at the 47 responses that I had gotten to all of my questions, the consensus that emerged was very different. They said he was hiding in a kind of dugout space, like a cave under a little compound that was in a village near the city of Tikrit, and they described and drew pictures of the houses, of the house that he was in. It was a funny kind of a house, and it had two big palm trees at either end of the house, and that was unusual because there aren't a lot of trees in that part of the world, and that there was a river that ran in the back of the house and a road that ran in the front, and that he was down and crouched in this little hole, and that there was a vent so that he would have air, that he would look like a homeless person. He would have this wild salt and pepper hair and this wild beard, and of course he had glossy black hair and glossy. He was clean shaven when you saw him before that, and that he would be wearing dark, dirty clothes, and he'd be crouched down there. He'd have a gun, but he wouldn't use it. He would be very dispirited and depressed. He'd have a quantity of money with him, that he would only have two or three people with him. And on and on. And so I duly recorded all this, although I didn't agree with it. I didn't think it was true. And I had it turned over to my analysis turned over to the director of the university, who had it all notarized and put into an envelope, and then the notary sealed the envelope and signed her name and put her seal over the envelope, and it was put in a vault. And the reason I did this is so there would be an unimpeachable chronology of prediction, descriptions, and whatever actually happened. And so then the conference ended, and everybody went home, and this stuff was in the vault. And about 6 weeks later, of course, he was captured. And what happened? They found him underneath the little compound of farmhouses in a village near the city of Tikrit, in the little spider hole, they called it, and which had a vent, and he was dressed in dark clothes, and he had $750,000 with him, and on and on. The descriptions of the house were right. In the book, I actually have pictures that the soldiers sent me when they captured him on, I think it was the 13th of December, and we had provided these descriptions on the 3rd of November, about 6 weeks earlier.
Did yours go anywhere? Did you send them to
anyone?
Well,
you know, it's always very hard to know that. No, I did not have a way to operationalize it. However, there were in the class of the 47 people a number of people from the intelligence world and from the military world, and so, you know, who knows? I don't know. I mean, I have no direct knowledge that it was useful, but then, as I say, there were people who were in that world, and they could have passed it on. That's the problem with doing things like this. It's not the remote viewing that is the problematic part. It's getting it operationalized, which is why, just in passing, that I have not done Osama bin Laden, because I've demonstrated people can do it. There's no point in doing that again. It needs to, I would be very happy to do it if there was an operational team of soldiers or operatives that were on the ground who could follow up on the information.
Well, it seems my first knowledge about remote viewing years ago came sort of via the government programs, and, you know, the Russians started it, or I don't really know who started it, but, you know, sort of in the rumor mill, that's what was going on.
Right.
And it's surprising that the government wasn't on this task using remote viewing. Maybe they just had to stage so many things before he actually was found. Do you
don't think they were using it. The government, I was not government funded. I would not do classified research. My belief was from the beginning, and I turned down government money. My belief from the beginning was that we know so little about human consciousness that if we learn something, it ought to be freely available immediately to everybody. But other people made different choices, and in the up at SRI, they did a lot of classified spying, basically. I don't think that they were doing it by the time of Saddam Hussein, and the reason is that program had closed after the CIA had spent about $20 million supporting it. And it closed, at least in part, because the religious right thought the whole thing was satanic. Certain congressmen did, key congressmen, and so they just stopped doing it. And it was also very controversial because people have such strange and biased views about this. You know, is it satanic? Is it the devil speaking? I mean, all kinds of nonsense.
Well, it's, in a way, that, in a sense, has worked in our favor, you know, like with all the laser technology and everything. They're making these incredible weapons. And yet, if they really put all the focus with that sort of technology into the medical realm, wow.
Oh, well, if we spent the money we spent developing weapons, devising a way not to be dependent on petroleum, not to be addicted to petroleum, if they'd started in 1973 with the first oil crisis, the world would be an utterly different place today, both in terms of global warming and in terms of geopolitics. I mean, if the amount of money that went into Iraq in 1 month had been put into alternative energies, research, wind and solar power, for instance, $12 billion a month we're now spending there, we'd be looking at a completely different world. So it's about choices that we make.
Right. And you said it in a nutshell, geopolitics. There's actually a gentleman who's born in Italy but has since become an American citizen. During the Carter administration, he was asked by their Department of Energy to please go to Harvard and research, and he found out some very compelling and amazing information, and now no one will go near him. It's like he doesn't even exist in a way. And he's figured out some things that we could use other than oil. So anyway, that's another topic. Let's stick to more about your work. Although it's,
well, that's also a topic. You know, on the Schwartz Report, my daily web publication, I follow the trends that are shaping the culture in the world. And so I do a lot of work in that area as well. But I know you want to talk today about the work and research into the nature of consciousness that I've been doing.
Yes, and two things I'd like to bring up now. One is, you know, I've sort of researched a fair amount about remote viewing, and where and how you work with it is just something I so appreciate, because you are looking at it as a tool for higher consciousness, as far as I can tell. It's not just about, oh, well, let's, you know, make this report and let's see if we can, you know, make it work or prove that it works. I mean, there's no doubt that it works, and it just cracks me up that there are actually these people that have organizations formed to actually say, no, something like this does not exist. The skeptics are organizing.
Well, they're professionals. You know, they're not really skeptics. What they are is professional deniers. And they're just like the professional deniers about global warming, or they are like professional deniers in some religious movement. I mean, they don't have any science on their side. I mean, if you look at the criticism that skeptics put out, they don't actually have any science. They basically say it can't exist, and therefore it doesn't exist, and it because it doesn't fit with their paradigm, their worldview. I mean, I've been doing this for almost 40 years, and have been mercifully left alone. I don't have to waste my time with this. And the reason that I think skeptics have largely left me alone is that I do this stuff out in the public. It's witnessed by dozens, sometimes hundreds of people. I film it all. I keep an absolutely rigorous control over the information, so that, as I said earlier, I establish an unimpeachable chronology.
Yes.
It's often always filmed, so it's very hard to take it on. I mean, you can make ad hominem attacks about me, I guess, but to take on the actual data that comes out of the research, that doesn't happen, because it's not like there's a sort of alternative data. The reason I got interested in this, as you correctly surmise, is I'm interested in the nature of consciousness. And what I have discovered over time, over many years of doing this, and what I describe, I hope, effectively in Opening to the Infinite, is that the experience, the aha moment of genius that people like Brahms and Beethoven and Picasso and Madame Curie and Michelangelo, those kind of people, that we unequivocally accord the title creative genius. If you look at what these creative geniuses say, what you discover is that they describe this non-time-space holistic experience. That is exactly the same kind of thing that religious ecstatics describe. And it is also the same sort of thing that remote viewers describe when you ask them, what's the experience like? It's kind of like a daydream. I see things in a timeless time. It's like I see a hologram. There is a fractal quality to it. I can see anything I want from the smallest piece. And those kinds of statements, which you find in the creative genius, in the religious ecstatic, in the remote viewer, tell me that all of that is one thing. The difference between the religious ecstatic, the scientist, or the creative artist, and the remote viewer is a matter of context and intention. That is, the scientist wants to see a fundamental principle, and so that's what the experience is like. The painter wants to create a great painting, or a composer wants to create great music, and so that's the experience they have. Brahms says, I move into an altered state of consciousness, and in that altered state I can hear the music. And it is the same thing that the remote viewer does, or says that they experience. The only difference is context and intention.
Don't you think that this sort of aha moment comes completely randomly as well, though?
Well, I think, Robin, that what happens is that we are always have access to this information, but it's at a preconscious state.
Yes.
And occasionally it bubbles up. I have a hunch. or you can very deliberately go after it, which is what the remote viewer does. But the important part is that this is perfectly normal human functioning.
Exactly.
Most of the time it takes place pre-consciously. And what remote viewing is, as I said earlier, is basically just a technique, a kind of mental martial art, which allows you to open to this information that you have access to anyway, but you don't know that you have access to it. So it's a way of training your mind to allow yourself to open.
Yes. In speaking about Jonas Salk and non-locality, you quote him in your book as saying, intuition is something we don't understand the biology of yet. And let's take this historically. How many years ago was that? And do you think that there is a place in this non-locality where you just can't really even go there with science?
No. First of all, there's not a place because there is no place. It's outside of time space. I mean, part of the problem we have, Robin, is
right.
That,
I mean, that's what I mean. It's like, can science reach?
Yes. Actually, what I think is going on, I certainly do not mean to imply that this is general to all science, because it isn't. But if you look across many disciplines today, what you discover is that science and spirit are converging, and that the insights of one are confirmed by the research of the other. If you look at the remote viewing research, if you look at the healing research, if you look at the near-death research, if you look at the reincarnation research, if you look at the meditation research, and we're talking about thousands of papers now. I mean, there's over 2,000 papers alone, for instance, in the healing literature. And there's probably 1,000 in the meditation literature, and there's hundreds in remote viewing, and then there's all the quantum entanglement papers. And so this is a large body of very carefully conducted research reported in often very prestigious peer-reviewed journals. If you look at all of it, you can see that the experiential description of great sages or spiritual teachers. I mean, you can go back, for instance, to the Sutra of Patanjali, which is over 2,000 years old, and read descriptions that are very much in support of or consistent with the discoveries that are being made in research labs that are looking at consciousness. The oldest remote viewing description that we have in the recorded record, and it is essentially unchanged from the way we would do it today, is a report of what's called an outbound, that is somebody goes out and hides and you describe where they are. An outbound experiment that is in the 46th chapter of Herodotus, describing Croesus, of whose name we all know as being as rich as, who was the king of the Lydians and got a what amounts to a remote viewing from the Delphic Oracle, again, over 2,000 years ago. So this stuff has been recorded. These experiences have been recorded in a myriad of different ways in every culture that humanity has ever produced. It was described prior to the development of science. And remember, science is only about 300 years old. History is about 6,000 years old. And people have been around for about 35,000 years. So the vast majority of human history or of human experience actually occurred long before science began. Science is this tiny little thing at the very end. But the descriptions that you get, no matter what culture you go into, whether it's the East or the West or Native Americans or whatever, they describe this process of opening to this part of the self. And what's happening is that science is confirming many of the statements that are made by spiritual teachers and sages and shamans and that sort of thing. So what I see is that science and spirit are converging. Now, that makes a lot of people terrifically uncomfortable because there is in science, as in the West, a very strong bias toward materialism. That is, dead meat, no consciousness. Or, put the positive way, I guess, we are nothing but animated meat. Our consciousness is just the result of biochemical and electrical processes in our neuroanatomy, and we are completely locked inside of our physical organisms except for our five normal senses.
Well, in speaking about the senses, there are some spiritual practices that almost start with the premise that if you can hear, see, smell, taste, or touch something, it's an illusion. It's part of the human mind makeup rather than that non-local mind.
Well, I think what they're trying to say, I mean, I don't know the particular ones you refer to, but what I think you see is in the experiential material, which is the spiritual teachings. Remember, I mean, it's important to remember, before we had science, if you had a precognitive experience, a future knowing experience, Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream in the Bible, for instance, the only way to describe it was within the context of contacting some kind of deity. I mean, whether it was a Christian god, or before that it was Zeus, or before that it was Mazda, I mean, that's not the point. We give it a cultural context. That
yes.
is, we have a story we tell about the experiences. But until the development of science, the only way we could visualize or conceptualize these kinds of experience was to say that they were divine, or that they came from God or gods or whatever. There wasn't really any other way to talk about it. That was the point I was trying to make. It's only in the last couple of hundred years, and really only in about the last 75 years or 100 years, that we have had techniques which science has developed to explore these timeless recorded experiences that people have been having, and to put them in a new context, that is, to put them in a scientific context. So from my point of view, or at least the way I look at it, people have been reporting these experiences for thousands of years, but it's only in the last century that we have had anything other than a way of describing it as being talked to by the gods or God or spirits or whatever.
We'll have much more with Stefan Schwartz next week. In the meanwhile, stefanschwartz.com, or for any guest information, to listen to archived programming and to share resources, it's tributariesradio.org. I'm Robin Clare. Thank you for staying tuned.